from New Orleans, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Without music, most movies would be downright drab. No one would be singing in the rain. The guys in Chariots of Fire would be running inexplicably in slow motion. And in Casablanca, Sam would have nothing to play, much less play again. This week, we're talking movie music with NPR's Bob Mondello, jazz great Terrence Blanchard, whose movie music we're hearing right now, and director Ben Zeitlin, whose early compositions sounded like this. He's the original beast of the Southern Wild. Start up the popcorn machine, baby. We're loving the movies. After the break. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. With rare exception, music is essential to the movie-going experience. Music helps explain who's who on screen and where the action is taking place. Take the 1958 movie King Creole. Could this song be sung by anyone but Elvis or anywhere but New Orleans?
Went down to New Orleans at the Golden Goose. I grabbed a green-eyed dolly that was on the loose. And while I did that music, well, she said to me too, I said, pretty baby, come on and let's do the Dixieland Rock.
Dixieland Rock.
Well, the Dixieland Rock.
Dixieland Rock.
Lift your head and sugar and shake it free. And do the Dixieland Rock.
NPR's Bob Mondello joins us. Bob has been the chief movie critic since NPR was only yay high. He's on the line from Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Gwen, it's great to be here.
It seems as if movie makers have always recognized the importance of having music accompany their images. So I'm thinking of, like, the silent pictures, Bob. I'm thinking about Mary Pickford and Charlie Chaplin and the rest.
Absolutely. Almost all the silent films were accompanied by soundtracks from the very beginning. Not soundtracks, excuse me, but by music from the very beginning, whether it was a guy playing the piano in the front of the Nickelodeon or a symphony orchestra in a place like the Fox Theater in Atlanta, where you wanted something a little more substantial. But yeah, in the teens and 20s of the last century, music provided the technicolor. Everything was basically black and white. You wanted to have some more there. Charlie Chaplin actually wrote his own music. He wrote the song Smile. Smile though your heart is breaking,
oh,
smile even though...
I love that song.
He wrote that for modern times, and it's... He regarded music as essential from the very beginning.
As moviegoers, expected to understand that the music that we're listening to is somehow a reflection of the character who is on screen?
Well, yeah, in a way. I mean, if a musician, a composer who's designing a score for a film is going to create a theme for a character. That's true in Star Wars, it's true in everything else, that when Princess Leia walks on screen, there's a theme that follows her, and it follows her through the music and through the movie. And yes, it's essential, and it does tell you kind of what she's thinking at any given moment, or at least underscores what she's thinking, so that if she's getting excited, you might expect the tempo to pick up a little bit, and if she's it's a romantic moment, then everything will be calm and maybe kind of lush. So yeah, it tells you a lot about what the person's thinking.
Well, what are some of your favorite, you know, musical moments in film? I mean, you watch, what, 300 pictures a year?
Roughly, yeah. It's a few fewer than that, thank heaven. But yes, well, a lot of things come to mind. I mean, in Apocalypse Now, there is that bum ba bum 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 ba bum bum, which accompanies the helicopters, which is like just absolutely pins that moment. One use of music that I thought was really fascinating. Kenneth Branagh did a movie of Henry V. You remember?
Oh, yes, I remember it very well.
And he was, a lot of people said at the time that he was doing the same kind of thing that Laurence Olivier had done.
Who had played Henry V. And directed
the films. And yes. It was a very different way of doing it back then because he was using Henry V to be all about World War II and about the entrance into war. And Kenneth Branagh was using the battle scenes in Henry V to talk about how terrible war was and devastating. This is the speech that Henry V gives to his troops on the eve of battle. He is about to lead them into this huge charge. They are so outnumbered by the French, and he's taking them into battle, and he tells them that they should be proud to be there. Well, Laurence Olivier did it without music.
Yes.
And he let the power of his voice carry him.
Let's listen.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, be he ne'er so base. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day!
Now, that was perfectly powerful in 1942, but when Kenneth Branagh did it, he decided to goose it up a little bit.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day!
Oh, my God, right? I mean, you'd follow this guy anywhere.
It's amazing. Would. I think that, to be honest with you, I think that everybody should listen to this speech on Monday morning before you roll out of bed. It will inspire
that would get you started.
Exactly, absolutely. And go to work or go to school or do whatever you're supposed to do, because it really does rouse the troops. Now, here in Louisiana, obviously, there have been quite a few films that have been set here. One of my favorites, which is, of course, A Streetcar Named Desire. That's the Elia Kazan film. Has a perfect cast, perfect director, perfect everything.
Blanche and Stanley. Blanche Dubois, who comes to New Orleans sort of down on her heels. She's her life has gone wrong. She is filled with dreams that are not coming true, and she meets the husband of her sister, who is a brute. And she is delicate and flighty, and he is a brute. They have a clash. It's quite a clash.
It really is. And as you say, the Blanche Dubois character is extremely delicate. And so music seems to follow her wherever she goes. And in these scenes in which she's actually interacting with Stanley Kowalski, played by, of course, Marlon Brando, you get the feeling that she's trying to keep the music in the scene and he's trying to take it out.
You must be Stanley. I'm Blanche.
Oh, your star sister.
Yes.
Oh, hiya. Yeah, where's the little woman?
In the bathroom.
Oh. Well, where are you from, Blanche?
Well, I live in Oriel.
In Oriel. Oriel, huh? Oh, yeah, that's right, Oriel. That's not my territory. Man, look, it goes fast in the hot weather. You want a shot?
No, I rarely touch it.
Well, there's some people that rarely touch it, but it touches them often.
A Streetcar Named Desire is purportedly the first major motion picture that features an entirely jazz score. That was written by Alex North, who was, in fact, a big Duke Ellington fan.
This is a wonderful score. You can hear the difference in the two of them, the thumping thing that they're doing for him and that sultry thing that they're doing for her.
Exactly.
And it is really compelling. And this is an example of having themes for characters and things like that. They're not connecting, right? It doesn't feel like it's coming together.
But there's also a very seductive aspect to this, to the sound, in the sense that, I guess Blanche is trying to weave her magic, but at the same time, Stanley is trying to seduce her in some kind of way.
Marlon Brando walked on that screen and seduced everybody. It wasn't just Blanche. And, you know, this was his first big picture. It was the first time we'd seen him, and he comes in and takes off his shirt, and oh, my God, you know? So that everybody was sort of reacting to him as a gorgeous animal up there on screen, right?
Exactly.
And in choosing to do a picture in the 1950s, that was black and white, you're making a statement of sorts that you want this to be gritty and real.
That's
right. And the music is pulling you into a different place.
Thanks so much, Bob. It's been a thrill.
It's great to be with you again. This is terrific.
NPR's movie critic Bob Mondello speaking to us from Washington. Coming up, if your mother were a character in a movie, what would her theme song sound like? Stay with us. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. If movie music tells us who's who on screen and where the action is taking place, then what do you make of this original song? Of the Southern Wild turns on the story of a little girl called Hush Puppy, who lives in the southernmost reaches of Louisiana, which is to say, surrounded by water and quickly losing ground. Hush Puppy lives with her dad, but the absence of her mother from their lives is a matter of hurt, ambiguity, and longing. Dan Romer and Ben Zeitlin found a way to communicate this musically with original composition and a song from Tin Pan Alley. Director Ben Zeitlin joins us here at Elephant Quilt Studios in New Orleans. Thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
What is your background in music?
I don't really have a formal background in music. My friends asked me when I was in seventh grade if I would join their band because they thought I was the one who could scream the loudest.
Can you?
At that time, I was going through puberty, so I had a real high, shrill shriek that they thought was perfect for the kind of, Nirvana derivation they were after. So I basically started singing in that band. I taught myself how to play guitar. I started writing songs for that band. And that was like my entire life through high school. And basically, you know, writing for when I started getting more interested in movies, I didn't want to stop writing music. And I kind of transitioned through writing for theater and then eventually started writing music for my own films.
And so where did you grow up? Where were you in seventh grade when you were doing your Nirvana imitation?
I was in a town called Hastings, which is right above New York, which I moved to. I grew up in Queens and then I moved to Hastings. And was completely shunned from society. And so this moment where these guys asked me to be in a band was like the first good thing that had happened to me living in this new town. And so it really became a huge part of my life.
Wow, that's interesting. So how good is your shriek today? Can you really shriek?
I can still scream pretty loud.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Can you give us an example? Sold! That's pretty good.
You know, I got training, you know.
What was the name of the band?
The band was called Sorry Porky, and thank God there's absolutely no record of our music that can be found.
Sorry Porky.
Yeah.
Okay, don't look at me when you say that now. Now, the thing is, so you wrote for your band, you wrote for theater, and then as you got into films, as you say, you decided you didn't want to give that up as well.
Yeah, no, it was never like I don't think I ever sort of made a I don't think I ever make a whole lot of sort of strategic conscious decisions in general, but it was never sort of thinking, oh, I want to be a composer director.
Right.
You know, it just starts from making short films, and you literally, you can't get anybody to help you, so you do it yourself, you know, and everything sort of started like that for me. And then as it developed, it started becoming hard for me to imagine making a film where I wasn't writing the music. It just became part of the thinking of how it was written and how it was edited, and it just ends up being kind of sewn into the process.
Well, so tell me about Dan Romer. Here's a guy who is also a New Yorker, producer, engineer, film composer, but who's this guy?
Dan, this is how almost every story begins of people who worked on my films, but Dan and me knew the same people in high school, and actually the band that I was telling you about, the members other than me went to a school called SUNY Purchase where Dan was going. Dan is a brilliant songwriter, brilliant composer, brilliant producer, and, you know, we really just found like a great collaboration.
One of the things that I love about your film is that it doesn't overdo music. You know, there's often a tendency in lots of pictures, you know, in which there's so much music that you kind of are distracted from what's happening on the screen. Did you all make any particular decisions about that, the use of music and how much you want it in the film?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's always a huge sort of battle in your head. And you know, what it comes down to me, it's always about redundancy. You know, the places where you notice that music is too much is when the music is telling you the same thing that the script is telling you, the same thing that the visuals are telling you, and everything is telling you the same thing. And it's like listening to someone repeat themselves, you get like, oh God, is it
so boring?
Please move on, you know?
Yes.
And so for me, that goes back to the writing process where, you know, an example, you know, is at the beginning of the film when Hush Puppy's running with fireworks in her hands. And, you know, if you take the music out of that, you would think, oh my God, this girl is going to set herself on fire. This is horrible. I don't want to watch this film. Like, this is a disaster,
this
you know?
This is self-immolation.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But, you know, in writing it, I knew that, you know, the score is not telling you what's happening. The score is telling you what Hush Puppy thinks is happening. And for her, it's this glorious moment of
magic,
family and tradition and her customs, and everything is beautiful. And so you give it this cinematic, you know, national anthem theme, and you're getting information crossing paths and coming in two different ways and building on itself. And so whenever the music is doing that, I always feel like, you know, you're doing the right thing. One of the things that took us a long time to figure out is that the music is really broadcasting from Hush Puppy's head.
Yes.
In the entire film. And that was real tough because, like, there's lots of places in the film where we wanted to use music. But if Hush Puppy isn't imagining anything or thinking anything, if she's just sort of sitting there, there's no way to put music in. It
right.
really would always feel completely wrong. And so that figuring out, like, when she starts to drift and when she comes back was a whole process that we had to do in post to figure out when she's broadcasting and when there's radio silence.
Now, as we mentioned before, I mean, the film tells the story of this young girl, Hush Puppy, and her father, Wink, is his name.
That's it.
And but the absence of the mother in the story, it's filled with all sorts of, you know, hurt and ambiguity and longing. And so you feel the presence of the mother throughout the film.
Yeah.
And so tell us about Mama's Song.
Yeah. No, we needed to give we needed to give her a very different musical texture from the rest of the film.
The mother?
The mother, yeah. You know, because of exactly what you're saying, that she had to be this presence that was very palpable, even though she's never around.
Mm-hmm.
personal mythology for the mom, which is that basically all House Preppy knows is that she swam away. And when you're in South Terrebonne Parish, you know,
which is where we shot the film,
you know, far away does not mean Japan. Far away means New Orleans. Like, it made sense to me that this far away feeling would be sort of a jazz New Orleans feeling and very much inspired by the Fats Waller song that we use in the film. That and sort of French jazz chords. Like, we wanted to use a very different chord. Mm-hmm. And so we sort of listened to a lot of Edith Piaf for the mom and sort of hybridized this sort of like tough, elegant feeling that Edith Piaf has with a sort of like woozy Fats Waller piano feeling. And sort of that's how that song was born, was kind of giving that very specific feel like its own place and never using it unless the mom was being thought about. And so
exactly.
Anytime you see her, you feel this one chord that, you know, you doesn't exist in the rest of the film.
Okay, so Ben, can you name that chord?
No. This gives you a good indication of how important Dan Romer is to our process.
No. Now, the thing is, there's a wonderful sequence in the picture where Hush Puppy and her friends decide that they are going to go to this place that's sort of far off on the other side of the water to continue Hush Puppy's search really for her mother.
Mm-hmm.
And they take a ride with the pilot of a commercial vessel over water.
Oh, yes, Sergeant Major.
Yes, and the actor?
Is Jimmy Lee Moore.
Jimmy Lee Moore.
Where are we going?
It don't matter, baby. This boat will take you exactly where you need to be. Just that kind of boat. Want a chicken biscuit? It's good for you. I've been eating these all my life. I keep the wrappers in the boat because they remind me of who I was when I ate each one. The smell makes me feel cohesive.
I
want
to be cohesive.
Sure you will, baby. No doubt in my mind.
We have two different themes in there, sort of bracketing the scene. The first one is, again, you're listening to the mom chords, but they're being done. You know, we use this instrument called the celesta, which is
celesta.
It's like that little bell piano that you know from, you know, the Nutcracker suite,
yeah.
Things like that. You know, it's very childlike, sounds like a toy piano. And then at the end of the scene, when she says, "I want to be cohesive," you're actually going back to chords that you know from the very first scene of the film where she's at home, which has been lost. It brings her back to that place of comfort and home, and then also those chords that sort of are about this attempt to make things make sense.
Yes. No, it's beautifully done. And so here she is, she and her little friends, and they have reached this bar that is filled with, in a, you know, let's face it, in a harsh world, we would call these women prostitutes, you know?
we always said it was a slow dance, not pole dance club, though.
There you go. And these are women who are in sort of the beautiful slips and lingerie that, you know, pretty much that your mother used to wear, you
yeah.
know, back in the day. And, you know, what's interesting about them is that, yes, in a harsh world, you would call them prostitutes, but their whole job is to counteract the harshness of reality with comfort. They are comfort women.
Yeah, yeah, at least for the little girls, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, especially these, you know, you have four little girls who are all really orphans without mothers, and so we always called this sequence the Heaven of Mothers scene. Because, you know, these are these women without children on this boat in the middle of the water, and here are these children without mothers. And, you know, when they find one another, it's this incredible sort of moment of tenderness that really doesn't exist anywhere else in the film.
Yes, that's exactly right. And it's almost like love at first sight. Original composition sort of dissolves into that really beautiful song from Tin Pan Alley, until the real thing comes along. And we, you know, we who love the song always think about our favorite people who sing it, you know, Fats Waller and Billie Holiday, and I think Louis Armstrong does a nice version, as I recall.
But, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, but the song was written by Sammy Kahn and Saul Chaplin and Ellie Freeman. And it fits perfectly in this scene because we're never quite sure whether this little girl actually finds her mother.
Yeah.
But she finds a woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who will do.
Yeah.
I want money. I need to play the money. I can think of a name for you. And if that's in love, you will have to do.
You need something, baby? Well, what you want? You alone? That's it. Get in here. Let me show you a magic trick.
The Fats Waller version of that song, you know, has this just very strange ghostly piano playing that just kind of wanders and floats, and we altered the sonics of it a little bit, but something about that faraway feeling just sonically was really great, and of course the lyrics for the song are so much what the scene is about, you know, what you're saying, that she's, you know, she's desperately looking for a moment of affection, you know, whether it's really from her mother or from somebody just to stand in as her mother, you know, it'll do until the real thing comes along, which also is very much about, you know, for me, in my mind, the real thing is her father, you know, and so this is this moment of escapism where she's has to go get this comfort in order to go back and face the difficult real love with her father, you know, in the final scene of the film. And so it fit in all those ways. And I think the scene was probably inspired by it in some ways, you know. And then what you hear in the middle there is the moment where her mother actually, you know, or maybe her mother comes out of the kitchen.
And she's the cook at this bar.
Right.
And who plays her?
Javon Hathaway.
Javon Hathaway.
Yeah,
boy, she real.
She's the best, man. She's the best.
So did you find this song Until the Real Thing Comes Along, or was it Dan Romer?
I found that one. It's been one of my favorite songs for a long, long time.
Whether you want it to or not, I mean, you know, you've exposed a whole new generation of people to the song. And when you go on YouTube, for instance, and you pull up Fats Waller singing the song, you know, all the little comments are so cool. Like one person said, "Hush Puppy brought me here." Isn't that cool?
That's great.
You know, and another person says, "Best scene in the movie." And then a third person says, "I was touched by a song like this for the first time."
That's so cool.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I haven't been through the comment boards, but.
I mean, no, it's not, you know, an Academy Award or a Camera Door, but it's pretty cool.
Yeah,
you know?
No, that is really nice if the people like the song. And yeah, because, you know, it's, where do you hear that these days? I don't know. We just did a live performance of the score with the film. We remixed the film without the orchestral music in it, and we had a 30-piece orchestra.
What?
And played it in Prospect Park in Brooklyn to like 10,000 people, and that was, you know, it was really amazing for me because that's what I always wanted to do, and, you know, I sort of gave up on music and started making films, but somehow I managed to circle around and sneak in through the back door and get to have that experience. So, you know, it was the best.
Wow, congratulations. Are you going to do it again?
I hope so. I hope so. Yeah, I know they're talking about, you know, putting it up in other cities and, you know, yeah, it was really, really, you know, as a filmmaker, one of the really frustrating things is that once the film is done, you're completely useless. You know, like, it's like having a kid that's grown up. They're just, you can't control them anymore, you know.
Right.
But so the ability to actually be like in the moment in the film, playing the music as it was playing and sitting and watching the audience as they see the movie. You know, I don't know that I'd ever realized that I'd never seen that before or done that before, but it was absolutely fascinating to feel like you're inside the thing you created the way that a musician is, you know, every night. So it was, for a filmmaker, definitely, total dream.
Well done. Well, Ben Zeitlin is the director and co-composer of the music to Beasts of the Southern Wild. And he joined us here at Elephant Quilt Studios in Marigny, in New Orleans. Thank you.
Yeah, that's fun.
Coming up, who's more lovable? A Disney princess, Denzel Washington, or Wilhelmina Blanchard? Stay tuned. It's Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. In 2009, Disney released its first animated film set in New Orleans, The Princess and the Frog.
You must kiss me.
Excuse me?
You will enjoy, I guarantee. All women enjoy the kiss of Prince Naveen. Come, we pack her. That's new.
Look, I'm sorry. I'd really like to help you, but I just do not kiss frogs.
The story of The Princess and the Frog is based on the old fairy tale, but Randy Newman's score is original. The song Ma Belle Evangeline features our next guest on trumpet. Ladies and gentlemen, Terrence Blanchard. Blanchard has written or appeared on dozens of movie scores, including Malcolm X, Original Sin, Jungle Fever, Cadillac Records, Inside Man, Crooklyn, Clockers, Lovin' Basketball, Red Tails, and Barbershop. He's like a film doctor. First, he examines the patient.
Well, generally, what you first try to do is watch an entire film and say, what does the film need and what is the film calling for?
Okay.
And then once you do that, you go back and spot the film and go through it scene by scene.
Yeah.
And you make general notes. And then, you know, it's a tedious process because you want the whole story to evolve. So we have to write like an actor acts because, you know, the actors shoot out a sequence.
Right. So they have to.
You know what I mean? So they always talk about an arc.
Yes.
In terms of being, where are they in the arc of the story? And when I'm writing, I have to think the same way because sometimes, you know, musically you get excited about something and you go, okay, but that's not where the emotion, where the energy is in the scene, in the film right now. Save that for something later. Chords will give you the general sense of, you know, certain types of emotion, but the orchestration can tell you how deep you're going to delve into that emotion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, for example, one of the funny stories I always tell people is that when Spike Lee was doing Inside Man, there was one love theme, and he came back and he goes, man, I want that to be the main theme. And I went, oh, my God. Okay, so now how do I take this and make it into this dramatic...
Sure.
Thriller type of theme.
We'll be right back. It's funny you should bring up Inside Man, because I was just about to bring up Inside Man. Okay. Isn't that fun?
Okay.
You know, this is the Spike Lee film. It's a bank heist kind of hostage situation sort of film, right? Mm-hmm. Denzel Washington starred in it. I think it was the biggest opening he's ever had, Spike Lee. And the biggest opening Denzel Washington ever had.
Both of them.
Obviously, Denzel Washington plays the police officer. Clive Owen plays the lead hostage taker, lead robber. And just the byplay between the actors, you could tell they were having a good time.
I'm going to walk out of that door when I'm good and ready.
Can I get you to do that today? I didn't think so.
Any other proposals?
Oh, please do not say proposals. My girlfriend, she wants a proposal from me.
You think you're too young to get married?
No, I'm not too young. Too broke. Maybe I should rob a bank.
You love each other?
Yeah. Yeah, we do.
The money shouldn't really matter.
Thank you, bank robber.
There are two selections that I'm hoping that we can listen to, and I just love them. One is called Defend Brooklyn. I don't know if you remember that one.
I remember when I hear it.
Isn't that an unsettling?
Well, that was the whole idea.
Of notes?
Well, yeah, the whole idea was to create this juxtaposition between this little sensitive kid, you know, being in the midst of this situation.
A hostage.
Yeah, and the thing about the kid was his acting was great, and his character was a great character, because he was a little kid where he kind of said, okay, I see what this is. But like any kid of this age that we're living in, he's like, yeah, that's cool, but man, can I play my game?
Exactly. You know? But it gets that little piece of music, it gets to the tedium of a waiting situation, you know?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And they sit for days, don't they?
Well, you know,
for a very long time, mm-hmm. waiting for something to give.
Yeah. And the thing about it is, it's a great thriller.
Yes.
But it's still very much a Spike Lee movie.
How so?
I've worked with Spike long enough to know his films always have a certain look.
Yeah, the colors are so
vibrant.
Vibrant, yeah. Mm-hmm. Very vibrant. And he clearly loves New York, because there are these mm-hmm. moments that only happen in New York these films. Like the scene I take away with me more than any other in Inside Man is when the police are befuddled because they're hearing a language they don't understand.
Oh, yeah.
And they play it, you know, before the crowd. And then some guy goes, that's Albanian.
Right.
I don't know Albanian, but my ex-wife is Albanian.
Right.
And that's how she used to talk.
Right.
You know?
Right. Only in New York. And it works.
There's another little piece of music called Dr. Phil.
Oh, wow.
It's just, again, it is unsettling. It's, you know, charming, but unsettling. So much about human psychology that you can through an audio mean make people squirm, because I mean I squirm in my chair when I hear that, because I know something's going to happen and maybe I won't like it.
Whenever you're dealing in music of any sort, especially in film, you cannot divorce your natural reaction to situations away from anything that you're doing.
Yes.
Musically, you know, so in that situation with the film, I kept thinking about how would I respond being a hostage.
That's right.
You know, in this situation.
My mind immediately goes to your soundtrack for the movie Red Tails.
Oh, wow.
The film is set in World War II.
Yes.
It's a George Lucas film.
Yes.
And it's a story of black airmen mm-hmm. who are serving during World War II in Europe.
Yes.
And there's a... I was supposed a character named Lightning.
Right.
And Lightning is in trouble.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when you hear this, you don't even need to know the name of the song, and you know this is trouble.
Yeah. You know, that's me playing a percussion.
No way!
Yeah, I mean, with this film, I took my time and in my home studio, started recording all of these different types of rhythms using djembes, dumbeks, congas, you know, all different types of percussion. So in Red Tails, you know, a lot of the stuff that you hear rhythmically is me playing in my studio.
I'll tell you what my one beef is in movies and mm-hmm. movie soundtracks. Mm-hmm. There are moments when directors rely too much on music.
Oh, yes.
Okay, I watched this film, Lincoln, which is a fabulous picture. Mm-hmm. You know, Steven Spielberg, Daniel Day-Lewis turns in a terrific performance, as do all the other actors,
yes.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But one of the last scenes of the film is Lincoln delivering the second inaugural address.
Oh, right.
Okay, that is, I'm sorry, a damn fine piece of writing.
Of course,
okay?
Of course,
I mean, that's why it's etched onto the wall of the Lincoln Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
You do not need music.
Well, what you're talking about is trust.
Yes.
And that's hard for some people sometimes. You know, cuz I've had conversations with directors about that very thing. I said, "Trust your film."
Yeah.
Trust your audience. And see, what you're talking about is one of those areas where you don't know where it's coming from, because it may not be a director.
That's
may be somebody else who's saying, "Hey, man, why don't we put a piece of music there, boom, 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 boom." I work with some directors where when we scored it, I say, "Hey, man, that doesn't need music." There's one film I worked on where we took a bunch of music out, and it was my music.
Yeah.
You know, and I kept saying, you know, you don't need music there. The scenes play great.
I mean, I'm not trying to, you know, pick a fight, but it just seems like Steven Spielberg has made a lot of movies in his lifetime, a lot of great movies.
Sure.
He should trust himself. He should trust his film. Yes. He should trust Lincoln.
Forever meet him, I'll tell him.
You've had some experience in front of the camera, of course, in the documentary When the Levees Broke, the Spike Lee post-Katrina documentary set here in New Orleans and all. And that must have been a much different experience for you.
Very.
I'm Wilhelmina Blanchett. I'm Terrence's mother.
And I'm Terrence Blanchett, and we're both born and raised here in New Orleans, Louisiana. It was a very different experience. You know, first of all, I've never been the subject of anything that I've worked on. And the other thing, too, is that I can't explain to you how personal it was. I mean, I know you're from New Orleans and you understand it, but when we were doing Inside Man, okay, that was right after Hurricane Katrina hit, and I'd moved my family to L.A., and we were staying in a little two-bedroom apartment that I normally had there for me to teach while I was teaching at the Monk Institute. And normally Spike, when we would do spotting sessions, he would fly me to New York.
Yeah.
And he called me up and he said, "Hey, man, I know this is a tough time for you." He said, "So don't come to New York." He says, "I'm coming to you." And I never forget it. So he's coming out to L.A. to work with me on Inside Man. And when he walked into my apartment, he didn't even say hi. First thing he said was, "I'm gonna do a story on those Levees." And I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "'Cause those people's," he said, "their story needs to be told." And we were in the studio recording the music for Inside Man. And I hadn't seen my mom. I had just found her. I couldn't find her for 2 weeks. Didn't know where she was. And of course, I'm calling my mom for 2 weeks. I finally get her. I said, "Mom, I've been trying to call you for 2 weeks." You know what she said?
What?
She said, "I heard that thing buzzing in my purse." But I didn't know what it was.
Thanks, Ma.
Her and her sister, my uncle, they had driven to Mississippi. But I found her, flew her out to L.A. where I was. So I brought her to the session. So I go out to conduct the cue with the orchestra. And unbeknownst to me, Spike has turned to my mom, said, have you gone into your house yet? And she said, no. And I come back in for a playback. And the first thing Spike tells me, we're going to film your mom going into her home.
Wow.
And I look at my mom and I go, okay. But when I got her home to the apartment, I said, Mom, do you realize that's a very personal thing? And I said,
oh,
you
yes.
know, there's going to be a ton of people around. It's going to be a crew. And my mom said, you know, yeah, but people need to see what we're going through. Driving all the way back to my mom's house, you could see the water line.
Yeah.
You know, 10 and 12 feet high on all of the houses.
This is so strange. Yesterday, coming in New Orleans, I just got so full because I knew I was going to see my house for the first time.
Yeah.
And not knowing what I'm going to see, I'm just at a loss.
Yeah. And I was really proud of my mom at that moment, but the sad part about it was my mom was still holding out hope that her house wasn't damaged. And so what you see on camera is really real.
Oh, look, this thing's way over here.
What is that?
That's the thing you gave me, it was over here. What is that over there?
What is what?
That.
That's a, that should look like your china closet.
The china closet don't have any business being over here, it's in the den.
I know.
Oh, Lord, the pictures I had in there. As soon as this picture's still up on the wall.
There's nothing on the wall.
Oh, Lord have mercy.
You can rebuild this stuff, though.
Yeah, that's easier said than done.
That's more.
Oh, Lord have mercy. Oh. Oh, I knew it was devastation, but I didn't think it was this bad.
Wherever I went, and people had seen the documentary, everybody talked about my mom. Oh, man, I lost it when your mom came on screen. Oh, man, give your mom a big hug for me, you know, let her know she's in my prayers. And the thing that I always had to correct people about was I appreciate the notion and I appreciate the thought, but what you have to understand is that if you cried for my mother in that documentary, you have to multiply that by 300,000 people at least, because that's the number of people that had the exact same experience. You know, it wasn't about my mom. My mom was there to show you and give you a glimpse of what everybody was going through. I've always applauded Spike for having the bravery and the courage to do what he did, because most people don't realize HBO only gave him enough money to do a 2-hour documentary. And when he looked at the scope of the story, he said, this is not a 2-hour story. He said, this is a much bigger story. And he still made it with only the money for a 2-hour documentary. So we all basically worked for free.
All of us. I did not know that.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that. A lot of people don't understand how dedicated he was to telling that story. That's why I was giving credit, man, because, you know, he didn't have to do that. And it was something truly memorable for me.
Thank you.
much, Terrence Blanchard.
Thank you, Gwen. Thanks for having me.
Terrence Blanchard joined us at Marigny Recording Studio in New Orleans. His latest project is an opera in jazz called Champion. And that's a wrap. You've been listening to Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Jenny Lawson, Rick G. Nelson, Sean Collins, and Jason Ryan. Music Inside Out is produced in partnership with WWNO. For a complete playlist, go to our website at musicinsideout.org. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Music Inside Out is underwritten by the Historic New Orleans Collection, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, Adam Newman Studio, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax deductible, thanks to our partnership with the National Performance Network. For more information on how you can support our program, go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.